Hi and welcome to the 15th addendum of Undisclosed, the State versus Adnan Syed. This week's addendum is Brady. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and national security fellow, and I blog at splitthemoon.com, and I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volcal Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2, and Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the editor of the Evidence Prof blog. Now, this week, we'll be building on where we last left off, with Christina Gutierrez fighting to get the state to hand over the evidence they were compelled to under the law. Remember, Tina had to prepare for the trial. But even as the very first day of the first trial loomed large, the state had refused to turn over things as vital as Jay's statements to the police. So we'll take a look at what else they refused to hand over and how Tina didn't court when she raised these violations as Brady motions. And then before we wrap up, we'll get to a few listener questions.
So in episode 15, we talked about the process of discovery, the way in which the defense gets information from the prosecution and vice versa. And we've talked extensively about Brady violations and the prosecution's duty to produce material exculpatory evidence to the defense. Now, one way that the defense can make sure the prosecution is upholding its duties under Brady and the Due Process Clause is to file Brady motions asking for what's known as Brady hearings, where basically the defense can claim that the prosecution is not turning over vital pieces of information, whether it be expert evidence, witness statements, or physical documents. So let's now go through sort of a timeline of various motions and discovery requests made by the defense and how the prosecution responded to them throughout 1999.
Just to recap, like we discussed last week, the first request for discovery from the defense was issued on May 17th. The state had until May 30th to produce discovery, and it didn't. It waited a bit, then in June, filed a motion saying they need more time because they're going on vacation. And then on July 1st, the defense filed a motion to compel discovery. 6 days later, the state finally coughed up its first discovery documents. Like we said last week, there was not much in there. On July 7th, the state filed its own motion, and that was to suppress witness statements on grounds of, well, it's a bit vague, but on grounds that disclosing the names of witnesses to the defense, somehow divulgence of these statements would cause an abstract harm to witnesses and evidence. On August 2nd, the state finally makes another disclosure, and this time they produce things like information about Mr. S, including Mr. S's police statements, notes of his first interview, and the transcript from his longer recorded interview, as well as polygraphs. Interestingly, though, there are a couple pages that just happen to be missing from that discovery, including, for instance, the page that shows he failed his first polygraph, and a page from the transcript in which Mr. S says he doesn't drink brandy. Now, I find it pretty interesting. Those are the two pages that happen to be missed from the discovery, but luckily, in this case, Gutierrez noticed it too, and she asked the state for it, and the state was like, oh, we found it. They got misplaced. Here they are now. So that got handed over. On September 3rd, the state made further disclosures, things like the fact not her real name Kathy was a witness, and that Mark Pusateri was a witness. They also notified the defense that the cell records were available for inspection. Of course, Gutierrez being what she was, she didn't actually go inspect it for a few months. On September 7th, the defense did two things. First, it wrote a letter to the state saying, there's a lot of stuff you haven't given to us. Here are some specific items that we need. They included, for instance, a request that the defense team be shown the following. The actual and exact location where Miss Lee's body was recovered on February 9th. The actual and exact location of the place where Jay Wilde says he met Adnan Syed on the afternoon of January 13th and was shown the body of Miss Lee. The actual and exact route that Mr. Wilde says he and Mr. Syed took into Lincoln Park. And the actual and exact route that Jay and Adnan took to leave the car and the location where the car was left, as well as how it was found.
I'm saying September 7th is when Tina wrote this, but at that point she didn't have any of Jay's statements, right? The prosecution had not turned it over, but she seems to have some very specific things she wants. I mean, things that seems to indicate that she actually knows somewhat of the narrative, right? That he met Adnan somewhere, that he was shown the body somewhere, that there were shovels involved. And how do we explain that?
Yeah. So like I said, there was two things that the defense did on the 7th. The other thing they did was to file a renewed motion to compel. And one of the issues listed in that motion was, for instance, moreover, the state has identified only upon inquest by this court that Miss Lee was murdered sometime in the afternoon of January 13th, 1999, but the state has contended it cannot establish the time of death with any further precision. Jay Wilds, according to the state, met Adnan Syed directly after the murder at a prearranged time and location and was present and assisted in the burial of Miss Lee's body in Lincoln Park. While the state has paraphrased Mr. Wilds' statements for various purposes, the state has not paraphrased or revealed any information regarding the actual times Mr. Wilds alleged this activity occurred. Similarly, the state paraphrased things like the locations of various places. So in its discovery responses, the state did give information in a very limited summary form, but they didn't actually give any statements over. Based on things like this, the state was able to say, for instance, to the best of the state's information, the victim was murdered on the afternoon of the day she was reported missing, shortly after she would have left school for the day on January 13th, 1999. If further investigation narrows the time down, the state will provide that more specific time to the defense. Which, of course, they never did, even though Jay's statements clearly give times. Obviously, the state knew there was a conflict between the times its witnesses claim things happened and times that matched the reality. So they avoided this problem by simply paraphrasing things. And that was one of the reasons that the defense was filing this motion to compel, because when you just have a paraphrase, vague generality of when things occurred and where they occurred, what are you going to do with that? This is the spine of Jay's story. The spine of Jay's story never changes, because the spine is what the state decided it could tell about Jay's statements without showing them for the ridiculous amount of inconsistent lies that they were. And the spine, for instance, was also used in the affidavits in support of the warrants, which did say things like, Wilds and Syed went to a location where they got rid of tools, which is how she knows about these things and how she was able to write and ask for a showing of where things happened while not knowing what the details were. Of course, like we discussed, Urich wrote back and said, showings are not part of the rules of discovery. I don't have to tell you anything. But this, you know, Gutierrez had a point. In her motion, in her Brady motions, she writes, information contained in Mr. Wilds' statements, as opposed to state selective paraphrasing, is critical to Mr. Syed's defense for the reasons argued above, and also to establish if there are any alibi witnesses for specific times. Surely the police or state questioned Mr. Wilds about the details of his meeting with Mr. Syed on January 13th, and about the details of his whereabouts, including precise times before and after the commission of the murder and the burial of the body. The release of Mr. Wilds' actual and complete statements, rather than the chosen snippets paraphrased by the state, is the only disclosure which can satisfy the state's obligations under the rules. And she wasn't wrong, because those statements do give times and locations, and they could have been used to develop alibis. Because at this time, the state had given so little over, the defense really couldn't put an alibi together. There was no way to know when Hay died, because all they knew, it was after 3 p.m. And since they didn't have any cell site data, they had no way of knowing the state was going to argue the burial was at 7 o'clock. And that brings us to the hearing.
This rule, which is 4-263B3, is purely designed to give a defendant sufficient information to be on notice if they need to make a Bruton motion to suppress co-defendant statement. Because there is no co-defendant going to trial with this defendant, there is no such situation. There is no requirement under this rule to provide any discovery at this time.
Here is where the defense's arguments broke down. Gutierrez tried to argue that under the rules, the state had an obligation to produce Jay's statements because they were statements of a co-defendant. The state argued, not unreasonably, that that's not what the rules say. The rules say they have to give over statements of co-defendants who are charged in the same proceeding, they don't have to hand over a statement of an accessory after the fact or anyone else not being charged with the defendant. And that's correct, more or less, because the rules of discovery in 1999 in Maryland didn't require the state to hand over that kind of material. The problem is that what Gutierrez was really trying to get at was the Brady issue. And she completely failed to explain to the judge what she was actually looking for and why she needed to have it. As we've heard in the clips, the judge concludes, well, no, your argument about discovery is wrong because you're misreading the rule. And more importantly, the state knows what Brady is and can be assumed to have given over stuff that was Brady. No, they couldn't be assumed to have done that because they hadn't, and they knew very well they hadn't.
Yeah, the clip that we had part of the last episode, you know, there was a lot of, it seemed like, argumentation between the judge and Gutierrez. And to me, it was really apparent that I felt like they were completely talking past each other. The judge did not understand what point Gutierrez was trying to raise. And that was because of her own failure to kind of communicate and make the point. It left a lot of people confused. But this was kind of a really important issue. The judge kept trying to make the point, and rightly so, that, you know, Gutierrez doesn't get to decide who, or nobody gets to decide other than the prosecution, the state, the executive gets to decide who is a co-defendant. And once they decide he's not, he's not. Simple as that. And Gutierrez was attempting to, if I understood correctly, say that that's not the issue.
I think she was trying to claim that if you have multiple suspects in a case, that could be exculpatory. If there's three people you think did a crime, the fact there is evidence pointing towards others is exculpatory for your client. And she was trying to argue that since Jay was also a suspect, that made his testimony, or that made his statements, by default exculpatory. Except that didn't apply here under the state's theory and under what the state was telling the court. Jay's statements were only making him a suspect in the sense that he was a suspect for accessory after the fact, and nothing in them made him a suspect for murder. Now, I don't think they're being genuine in those representations to the court, but that's what they were saying. So the court heard that and then concluded, and reasonably concluded, based on the assumptions he made about what the state was telling him, that no, Jay's statements weren't Brady based simply on the fact he was labeled a suspect. So on September 10th, the court gives its order, both on the first motion to compel from July and the second motion to compel in early September. The court's initial conclusion, though, was it didn't have to give an answer one way or another, because when she filed her motions to compel, she hadn't included a certificate required by Rule 426(3), which provides that the court need not consider any motion to compel discovery unless the moving party has filed a certificate describing good faith attempts to discuss with the opposing party the resolution of the dispute, and certifying that they are unable to reach agreement on the disputed issues. So, since no certificate was included, those motions to compel were legally meaningless. But the court decided to treat them as motions anyway, sort of. Although, it found that, apparently, the motions have been largely mooted by the state's disclosures. It decided that since the state had eventually made disclosures, that the motions to compel were, well, now resolved. Because Gutierrez failed to drive home the point that no, the disclosures from the state didn't really address the problems that she'd highlighted. They addressed some of them, but there were still issues outstanding that she never had gotten materials for, and the court was apparently unaware of this. As for the claims about Jay and the alleged Brady materials that Gutierrez was insisting existed and the state kept denying existing, the court concluded, a defendant's right to discover exculpatory evidence does not include the right to an unsupervised rummage through the state's files. No Maryland court has held that a defendant alone may make the determination as to the materiality of the information contained within the state's files. Settled practice is to the contrary. In the typical case, when a defendant makes only a general request for exculpatory material in a Brady, the state decides which information must be disclosed. Unless defense counsel becomes aware of exculpatory evidence that has been withheld and brings it to the court's attention, the prosecutor's decision with respect to Brady disclosure is final. My only response is, well, yeah, but how's that working out for us? Not too great.
Yeah, because essentially, I mean, for people who might not get that exactly, like what the judge was saying, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. Essentially, the judge is saying that by its essence, right, a Brady motion means that the state is withholding something from us. Then the state decide that's exculpatory, right, or has some impact on this case. And then the state can only decide what that is. And unless the defense counsel can figure out exactly what it is, you know, and articulate it, the state itself, like you have to, their determination is final, which is so ridiculous to me because it just gives so much power to the state. I mean, imagine the state has something that they don't want to turn over. The defense counsel never finds out about it because they have no means of finding out about it. And it can forever be lost. How is an attorney, how is a defense counsel supposed to discover everything that the state has if the state decides what you get to see? I mean, it's just this weird circular reasoning that really defies logic for me.
The court's decision wasn't wrong. I mean, that is the law. It's really a fundamental flaw in our system that relies on prosecutors voluntarily handing over the material that makes them lose. And a situation, moreover, where the only people who know that material exists are the prosecutors themselves. So the temptation has always got to be there, I'm sure, to not give over something that you know is going to hurt your chances of winning in your upcoming trial. Most of the time, prosecutors do comply with Brady. Most prosecutors want to do their job right, and most do not want to withhold exculpatory items. But there are ones out there who do. We've seen it time and time and time again. And the problem is there's no check on it. There's no way for the defense to be able to catch this because by definition, there's no way they can know about the materials that the state is not handing over.
Statements. The state at this time is completely caught up with discovery. We're ahead of where we're supposed to be. We've actually given stuff that we're not, that we've given everything that we're supposed to and stuff beyond that that we don't have to under the rules that we have provided.
As we heard in the audio of the motion to compel hearing, the state had represented point blank that it had no Brady material left, that it would not hand it over. I don't know how you can argue this is anything but a blatant misrepresentation by the state.
So on January 7th, as the second trial is about to begin, Gutierrez renews her Brady motion for Jay's statements. She says that despite the defendant's multiple discovery requests for copies of Jay's statements to the police before the first trial, the state kept maintaining that these statements contain no Brady material, and they didn't disclose them until the day of Jay's testimony. But when these statements were read during trial, it was obvious that Jay Wiles had given the police at least two different accounts of the crime and the surrounding events. And in Jay's second statement to the police, the detective himself said that these accounts contained too many inconsistencies to deal with, and Jay agreed with that characterization. Also, the state waited until the trial to release the statement of another witness, Jennifer Pusateri, who was with Jay for the portion of the day on which the murder was alleged to have taken place. Ms. Pusateri, or Jen, as I like to call her, is the only state's witness offered to corroborate Jay's statement of the death of Haman Lee and Adnan's involvement in it. However, Jen's statement directly conflicts with Jay's statements, both of his statements, with respect to several fundamental points about how that day went and what her interaction and Jay's involvement and Adnan's involvement was on the 13th. So as such, Jen's statement also qualifies as Brady. But despite the clear exculpatory and mitigating nature of this evidence that, you know, the state's chief witness lied to the police in reference to the death of Haman Lee, the state failed to disclose this information to the defense.
And this is another motion in which Gutierrez was on the ball because her arguments were all sound. Perhaps she wrote this one herself instead of leaving it for an intern to write. She was 100% correct. The state had violated Brady in a very provable way. And it was only because of the mistrial the defense was now able to move for those items specifically and knew of their existence. So Gutierrez could show very, very clearly that the state had violated Brady, had done so knowingly, and there was a really good chance they were continuing to do so now. However, after the hearing of this motion on January 14th, the court denied Gutierrez's Brady motion. It concluded, at the January 14th, 2000 hearing, this court questioned the state regarding any notes in their possession that led the police to seek Jay Wilde's second statement. The state proffered that it had provided all items that could arguably be used to impeach under Strigger or that were exculpatory under Brady. Since this case is a retrial, much of the material requested had already been provided by way of discovery, jinx, or as part of evidence that the state had a duty to disclose under Brady. Further, the state even agreed to turn over a statement of Juwan Gordon, a non-witness that the state does not intend to call at trial. Therefore, this court is satisfied that the defendant is in possession of any and all materials required under Brady and Strickler. No additional hearing was required, and the court is satisfied that all considerations have been met to afford the defendant the inquiry he requested on this issue. Basically, the state told the court, "Your Honor, we've handed over everything. We've given over all Brady. We have no Brady left. In fact, we've given over things we didn't have to give over, like the statement from Juwan." And the court, reasonably, didn't think the state was lying to her. And that was a mistake on her part, because either the state was lying or just so horribly inept it didn't realize that it had tons of Brady stuff that it had never considered giving over and had provided to Gutierrez in writing assurances that they did not exist. It's not the court's fault that she believed what the state was telling her, but it does show the problem in our system in which the state only needs to claim, "Your Honor, we've handed over all Brady," to resolve any and all issues in their favor. And the defense has very little way to counteract that.
You know, it's one thing that Tina was asking for things that she reasonably knew existed, but there are things she didn't know existed at all. Like things we know now, for example, the Crime Stoppers information, right? It existed. It should have been disclosed. It was not.
And that's not on her. There's no way she could have asked for that because, again, by default, if it's undisclosed Brady, you don't know what it is. She's not the state. She doesn't have the resources of the state. And she has no idea what the state has found in its investigation that it's not telling her about.
Well, Susan, I think you were being kind of charitable when you said maybe it was the state being inept. And I don't think that was it at all. You know, there's typical attorney gaming and then there's playing dirty. And I think this was playing dirty. We all can look at Jay's statements and there's no way you can look at those and say that those statements were not Brady material. He is so contradictory in all his police statements. It's so clear that, you know, these statements are so inconsistent that his credibility is shot. And also they can be used to impeach. But, you know, if the state didn't turn that over, it wasn't a mistake. That was on purpose. It was calculated.
Yeah, in that case, I don't disagree. There's not a chance in the world that Yurik didn't know exactly what he was doing. And he did it anyway and knew that he would not suffer consequences. At least not then.
So our first Twitter question comes from Cheerbank, whose Twitter handle is @Cheerbank. And Cheerbank asks, how was Hayes' diary not turned over to the defense before the trial started? The diary was actually turned over to the defense before the trial started. It was not, however, turned over to the defense well in advance of Adnan's originally scheduled trial. If you remember, Adnan's trial was initially scheduled for October 13th, 1999. But on October 1st, 1999, Yurik and Murphy filed a motion entitled State's Request for Admission of Excerpts of Victim's Diary. Their argument was not that the diary was admissible in its entirety, but that 12 limited excerpts qualified under exceptions to the rule against hearsay, such as a state of mind exception and the present sense impression exception. We'll talk about what those exceptions mean at another time, but you know, let's get to the meat of this. The prosecutors likely knew that they were facing an uphill battle when they filed this motion, because the entries in a victim's diary are almost always considered inadmissible hearsay. And even if they satisfy a hearsay exception, which would allow them into evidence, they are usually considered irrelevant to the issues of trial. For example, here's an excerpt from the 1993 opinion of the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland in the state called Morrison versus State. In the instant case, the record does not reflect how long after the event the victim made the diary entry. Since there was no evidence to show that the diary entry was made contemporaneously with, or even immediately after, the events described therein, it was not admissible as a present sense impression. Now, in response to the state's motion, Tina filed a motion for a continuance on October 12, 1999, on the eve of Adnan's trial. Here was Gutierrez's argument for delaying the trial. The state had Hayes' diary since January 13th, but waited to make its motion until October 1st. Gutierrez was on a business trip to South Carolina from October 1st to the 4th, so she didn't see the motion until the night of the 4th. Gutierrez then requested and received permission to view the diary on October 5th, but she failed to show up because she was in court for the Richardson trial, and that session ran late. Gutierrez then headed to Puerto Rico for one of her death penalty cases, and she sent an associate and a law student to review the diary. Tina, however, didn't get a chance to review the diary herself, and she didn't review it when she returned either because she was back in court for the Richardson case. Therefore, Gutierrez asked for a continuance because, and this is in her motion, due to the late disclosure of the diary, the defense will need additional time to fashion an appropriate response to the state's motion regarding the admission of the diary, which will require time to adequately review the diary itself and time to investigate the events and sentiments recorded in the diary through numerous other sources. Those other sources include seeking access to other documentation exclusively within the state's control. The next morning, October 13th, the state filed a response, claiming the state informed the defense of the existence of the victim's diary and its inclusion as evidence for trial in disclosure provided the defense on August 2nd, 1999, which included an evidence control unit submission list that listed the diary of Haley. The state would have made the diary available for inspection at any time upon request by the defense. The defense never requested to view it. So Tina's motion actually did get denied, but for other reasons, the trial still was continued until December 7th, 1999, maybe because of the court's own schedule. The question then is, did the defense rigorously review the diary and cross-reference it against numerous other sources in the ensuing 2 months, as it promised in its motion for a continuance?
Yeah, so there's no reference of Gutierrez or her team rigorously reviewing the diary, comparing it to other sources, et cetera. But what we do know in the end is this: the defense stipulated to the admission of Hayes' diary, and it wasn't just the 12 limited excerpts. They stipulated to the admission of the entire diary. Putting that in legal terms, the defense consented to the diary being admitted into evidence and also agreed that it would not appeal the admissibility of the diary if Adnan were convicted in the case. Now, it's really hard for me to communicate just exactly how insane this decision was. Basically, the very last thing that an attorney wants to do in a murder case is to allow the jurors to hear the victim speak from the grave. It both personalizes the victim and increases the likelihood of a guilty verdict based upon emotion rather than evidence. And as we noted before, there was established Maryland precedent that clearly Gutierrez could have used to argue that the diary should have been excluded either in part or in whole. But instead, Gutierrez stipulates to admission of the diary. The state uses it extensively during trial. Debbie reads from it. It's admitted as an exhibit. And in fact, it becomes the framing device for the state's closing argument at trial. So if we look to the start of that closing argument, prosecutor Casey Murphy says, "How can she treat me like this? The words of this defendant to Jay Wilds regarding Haley, as if she deserved to die. No one treats me like this. What does that mean? What exactly did Haley do to him? She fell in love with him. When you read these diary entries, you'll sense the joy and the excitement that she had about her relationship with this defendant. Entry after entry details the wonderful things they did together. Sure, they had their ups and downs, as in all relationships. This is what people do. We have relationships, we have ups and downs. And as all people, they broke up more than once. They got back together, they broke up again. And then as people do, Haley met someone else, Don. And at that point, it became readily apparent to everyone, including the defendant, she wasn't coming back. It happens all the time." So that was the start of Murphy's closing argument. And here's the end. "Haley wrote in her diary on May 11th, 1998, 'When I look into his eyes, I know that he loves me. I really love him.' And again, September 8th, 1999, Haley writes in her diary, 'I don't know what I would do without him. He is the sweetest person I have ever met. When life is hard, all I have to do is look into his eyes. Then it'll all be better.' Imagine the disbelief and terror when she looked into those eyes on January 13th, those same eyes that she writes so politely about in her diary, with one purpose: to kill her. And what was it she tried to say at that point in time? The words she tried to get out: 'I'm sorry. How could she treat me like that?'" So Murphy basically is using this diary as the starting and ending point for the prosecution's case. And it was really at the heart of a case that was long on rhetoric and short on evidence. And as we've said, simply put, it should have not been heard by the jury. And later, when Adnan directly appealed his conviction, one of the three arguments he made was obvious: that Hayes' diary was improperly admitted and that its words substantially prejudiced the jury against Adnan. Had it been really any other attorney handling his case, this could have been a winning argument on appeal. But as we said, Gutierrez stipulated to admission of the diary. The issue was waived. There wouldn't be a new trial based upon the diary. So, I mean, Susan, I mean, from my perspective, this was one of the biggest errors by Gutierrez. And You know, her motion for a continuance says, we're going to review this. We're going to go over it with a fine-tooth comb. And instead, like a matador, they just sort of wave it into evidence.
She made worse errors and more damaging ones, but this one's just so boneheaded it stands out. Why would you do this? You didn't have to stipulate to an admission of a diary that was not admissible in the first place. And you do nothing to use it in your favor. There were entries there that counter the state's case. She never used it. This question comes from Leni Vinnett, whose Twitter handle is @LeniVinnett. She writes, did I hear that correctly? Jay was in the car with Abe on the drive test? Yes, he was, although the state never disclosed this fact. And it's not the only information that the state failed to disclose in connection with the cell expert's testimony and the cell tower information testing. On October 20th, 1999, the defense sent a letter to Urich in which they outlined all the information they didn't have concerning the cell evidence and what they were seeking from the state. This included things like Abe Wornowitz's CV, his background, his experience, what a cell site is, what the meaning of something like L651C even meant, because they had no idea. They didn't know what on earth the cell expert's summary of findings meant, because they had no idea what cell sites were, what the numbers could possibly be referring to, where they were located. It was meaningless to them. 6 days later, on the 26th of October, the state responded to the defense's letter, and they give a very short and simple reply, which said, Mr. Wornowitz performed a test of the AT&T wireless system in Baltimore at our request. He orally reported the results of that test to us, and we have provided a summary of them to the defense in our previous disclosure. He has written no reports. And the other information the defense requests is either unknown to the state, not within the control of the state, or not discoverable. This is not true. We know the state failed to disclose vital information in response to this request, including the fact, for instance, that Jay was in the car for the drive test. What we also do know is that the state did eventually turn over Exhibit 31, the Frankenstein document that showed the cell towers pinged on the 13th, as well as things like maps of the cell testing, which the state had denied existed in the first place. We've noted before how Gutierrez could and should have challenged the admission of this exhibit on a few different grounds, and how this appeal likely would have been successful if she'd done so. Instead, what did she do? Just like with the diary, she stipulated to its admission. She let it come in without objection and said, sure, fine, bring in this evidence, even though the basis is unknown, the method of testing is unknown. Even though she knew nothing of what was going on or whether this evidence was valid in any way, she said, fine, bring it in.
What do you think was happening here? Was it just that she was overwhelmed? Do you think she could have been impacted by her illness? These seem like, for somebody as seasoned as her, I am completely astounded at things that are so obvious, like, you know, in terms of like bungling the case.
As far as I can tell, she was spending very little time on the case. She just
You don't even have to. I mean, like you don't stipulate to you know what I mean? On one hand, she files a motion to.
She make the call? But I kind of get a sense that she actually wasn't the one making these final decisions because, for the stipulations, what we have is the state sends over a list saying, here's what we want to stipulate to, and the defense just said yes. It's possible she was not the one saying yes there.
That's interesting.
I've mentioned this before. We know the first trial ended in a mistrial. That mistrial came about because of Exhibit 31, where basically Urich was trying to introduce it. Gutierrez claimed she hadn't seen it, and Urich says, what are you talking about? You stipulated. And the judge asks her, I assume that you didn't agree that you've seen what you've agreed to admit. And Gutierrez responds is, I agreed to the admission of cell phone records because I did not care. I had not looked at them. I had not seen it. It is not a lie. So that's her own statement to the judge in the case, is she didn't care to look at this exhibit. I don't know whether that was a lie, as the judge said. I don't know whether Gutierrez was telling the truth, but if you take her at her word, she just didn't care. She maybe didn't realize the significance of the cell tower evidence. It was the first time in Maryland it was admitted, but yeah, it's whether it's illness, whether it was pawning off work to her law students, for whatever reason, she just didn't care to look into the diary or the cell tower records.
Yeah, I get the sense that she just simply, or not she, someone in her office simply agreed to the stipulations, which is why they all came in when they shouldn't have.
No, it's just really erratic behavior to me that there are times in court where she battles fiercely. I mean, over issues like the clip we heard in the last episode. And then here she would say things like, I didn't care. And to me, I mean, it's one thing that she's busy, she's not doing preparatory work, but it's another thing to say, I didn't look at them, I didn't care, and that's why I allowed them in, which is frankly admitting that you just totally screwed up. I don't understand what was happening. It doesn't make any sense at all for any reasonable attorney to even say those kinds of things in court.
Yeah, Robbie, and I'll say you're spot on in terms of this inconsistent behavior by Gutierrez, and what Susan just read from is maybe Exhibit A. She doesn't care to look at the cell tower exhibits, but she does, luckily for Adnan in his current appeal, file a fairly specific and detailed Brady request for information regarding Warnowitz and the cell tower exhibits, because we've cited to the Ware case, it's a Court of Appeals of Maryland case before, and it says that although under Bagley, which is a case interpreting Brady, we no longer distinguish for purposes of determining the standard of materiality among cases in which the defense made a specific request as opposed to a general request or no request at all, the fact that the defendant made a specific request figures into the analysis nevertheless. So when Judge Welch is looking at the Brady issue with regard to Exhibit 31, the fact that Gutierrez actually did make a specific and detailed Brady request on the cell tower evidence is going to help that materiality analysis, and it's going to help Adnan to win a new trial. This next question comes from Sharon. Her Twitter handle is at SRB2245. She asks, hairs on Hayes' body, not Adnan's, would be CG incompetence or undisclosed? The answer to this question is possibly both. So Hayes' body was found in Lincoln Park on February 9th, 1999. An autopsy was conducted the next day. And then soon thereafter, Salvatore Bianca, who was with the trace analysis unit, analyzed hairs that were found on Hayes' body. His report, though, on those hairs was not turned over to the defense until December 2nd, 1999, about 10 months after Hayes' body was found and a mere 5 days before Adnan's first trial started. Now, according to that report, of the hairs that had characteristics sufficient for identification purposes, not a single one of them matched Adnan. Now, in response to this report, the defense immediately requested clarification. They specifically sought to verify that while none of the removed hairs belonged to Adnan, they also didn't belong to Hay. During the entirety of Adnan's first trial, however, there was no such clarification given by the state. In fact, it wasn't until 2 weeks after that first trial ended in a mistrial, this was on December 30th, 1999, that the state disclosed important information. And that information was that in addition to the hairs that didn't match Adnan, two of the hairs recovered from Hay's body did not match Hay's hair. So reading from the state's amended disclosure on December 30th, two hairs were determined to have sufficient characteristics so as to say they were not hairs of Ms. Lee. Further, they were not hairs of Adnan Syed.
This was another one of the non-disclosures that led to the motion for a Brady hearing on January 7th, 2000, which we've already discussed. In addition to the other items that Gutierrez asked for, she also asked for a Brady hearing on the grounds that the state failed to disclose this crucial piece of forensic evidence that strongly suggests the presence of an individual other than the defendant in physical proximity to the victim prior to her death. However, Judge Heard denied that request. At the second trial, when Gutierrez tried to pin Bianca down on the significance of these hairs, she wasn't very successful. In fact, Bianca seems to totally change his mind compared to his previous report and to his previous oral statement to Yurik.
Here is Gutierrez cross-examining Bianca at the second trial. Gutierrez, and those two hairs you compared with the known samples from Adnan and found that you're an expert opinion, they didn't match. Bianca, they didn't have all the physical characteristics that were in his range of characteristics for his hair, yes. Gutierrez, so it'd be fair to say that your opinion indicated that these two hairs did not belong to Adnan Syed. Bianca, I could not determine that they came from Adnan Syed. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, Susan, that it really doesn't seem to convey to the jury the significance of what the state disclosed on December 30th. And that significance, basically, there were two hairs found on Hayes' body in Lincoln Park, and she, you know, wasn't sort of out in the open where people would leave their hairs. Those two hairs definitively did not belong to either Adnan or Hay. We know Jay has said he never touched Hay's body. I mean, this, to me at least, pretty strongly points to some third person being involved in either the death of Heyman Lee or her burial.
Oh, it's worse than that, though, because on direct examination, what Yurick did was get Bianca to give some frankly bullshit testimony in which he says, oh, well, I couldn't confirm that they're Anand's hairs, but they have the same coloring, hint, hint, even though he'd previously denied that it was possible for them to be Anand's hairs. This is not evidence that they were Anand's hairs because he flat out states in his forensic analysis they were not consistent with Anand's characteristics. And aside from that, hair analysis in general is a defunct and untrustworthy forensic quote-unquote science. But the way the state presented it at trial turned what should have been exculpatory evidence into evidence that was falsely presented as pointing towards Anand's guilt.
Yeah, and this is yet another example of one of the failings of Gutierrez I've noticed, and that is you can look at the testimony of Debbie as another example. She has either a prior witness statement or a report by an expert. She is questioning the person at trial. They're giving testimony that's either contradictory to their reporter's statement or at least ambiguous. She doesn't bring up that statement or that report to really pin that person down. In this case, she should have gotten Bianca's report, read from it, made sure the jury was full aware and clear. We have two hairs in this case. They don't match Hay. They don't match Adnan. Boom. There's a third person who could be involved in the case, reasonable doubt, but never happens.
And let me add this, you know, I mean, during a trial, during cross-examination and examination, I mean, after a while, you know, people can even blank out. You get kind of, it gets kind of hard to even follow what's happening, especially with all the different language and the attorneys going back and forth. But the perfect place to like drive some of these points home is in the closing and closing statements. And we'll eventually get to Tina's closing statements here. But she also failed to just kind of hammer these things home during the closing. I mean, that was the point at which she could have said, you know, Debbie saw Adnan at this time and the coach saw Adnan at this time and the hairs didn't match. And Jay was at Jen's until 3:45. I mean, she really could have just one by one just easily hurt the state's case and shown what bunk it was. Because during weeks and weeks of testimony, sometimes, you know, you can kind of lose sight of all these different factors. But she also kind of dropped the ball in closing as well.
Yeah, and let's not take our eye off the fact that this is a Brady violation by the state. I mean, certainly Gutierrez dropped the ball at the second trial, but quite clearly the state did not disclose this before the first trial. Now, luckily for them, there was a mistrial, and on December 30th, they eventually disclosed the presence of these two hairs from another source. But if that first trial ends with a conviction, seems pretty clear to me this would have been found to be a Brady violation. And this is certainly another instance of prosecutorial misconduct.
Hey, I have a question for you guys. Was there any indication of where on her body it was found? When they say body, they mean body and not clothing, right?
I would not be shocked in the tiniest bit if it turns out they're Bianca's own hairs.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I'm serious. He's testified that he was like mixing up, like he couldn't tell the hairs and fibers from Hay's clothing. It's based on his record, I could easily see him actually having his own hairs contaminate the sample.
A final question that we'll take this week comes from Jenna, and we got it through Facebook. And Jenna says, love the show. I noticed a hole in the logic used in Don's time card issue that has been bugging me. It's standard operating procedure for many national chains to have a set of employee numbers for each location. So Don having a different employee number at a different store isn't unusual. And just because his time cards don't reflect that he earned overtime, that doesn't mean he wasn't paid for it. That will be something fixed on the back end in the accounting at the home office. Also, if it was the first time he worked at the other store, he may not have had logins to clock in since he didn't normally work there, so his time cards would have had to have been fixed after the fact. So what Jenna is referring to is an issue we brought up in last week's episode, and that is about Don, who was Hay's boyfriend at the time she disappeared, and his work records from the day of January 13th. Now, this is something that Susan, many, many months ago, blogged about, and then Bob Ruff on his Truth and Justice podcast has also covered in considerable detail. And in fact, has done quite a lot of investigating on this subject. So the basic issue is that Don has said that he worked at a different location of LensCrafters from the location that he normally worked at, which is Owings Mills, but that on the 13th, he worked at Hunt Valley. And when Christina Gutierrez asked lens crafters much later in 1999, it was like in October of that year, to produce his work records for that day, and lens crafters complied, there was no record of him working on the 13th. Then Kevin Urick, the prosecutor, got in touch with lens crafters, and magically a record appeared. And that record was for a different store. And that time card, which by the way is on Susan's blog, actually has a different employee number. So what Jenna is saying is that it's standard operating procedure for some chains to have different employee numbers. Now, the thing is that with lens crafters is in fact not standard operating procedure. And we know this because Bob Ruff confirmed it himself, not just with corporate headquarters, but he's also spoken to four different managers, including somebody who worked at the lens crafters in Hunt Valley in 1999. He's also had 20 different lens crafters employees contact him and confirm the fact that at lens crafters, even if you move between different stores, they're not franchises. If you move between different stores, your employee ID number stays exactly the same. So that's an issue we can put to rest. Definitely, he did not have two different employee ID numbers. Don would have had one. So we're not sure why a different one showed up on his Hunt Valley time card. The other thing is that Jenna raised that he might, the time cards could have been fixed after the fact. But again, we've had confirmation from LensCrafters employees that time cards can only be fixed up until, or corrected or made any changes made up until the end of a given pay period. And that pay period that of January 13th actually ended on January 20th. So whatever changes had to be made, whatever time had to be entered, had to be done by January 20th of 1999. And so that time card was created by then. Lastly, the issue of him not having earned overtime, you know, that's true. It could be that if this is something that can be explainable, you know, innocently, and he would have gotten overtime pay for it and it was fixed later, certainly that's possible. But the problem is that nobody ever retrieved those, his actual payment records. So we have no idea whether or not he was paid overtime or what hours he was actually paid. Hopefully that answered your question, Jenna. And of course, we all still have lots of questions about the time cards and whether or not Don was actually at Hunt Valley, and if not, where he was that day. Having never practiced criminal law, I've always been a bit appalled at the games played, especially by the state, to fight discovery of evidence. I'm not assuming now that all or even most prosecutors do this, but it's bad enough that they have the power to do it if they want to. They're the ones with all the police documents, the forensic evidence, the lab reports, and the witness statements. They get to decide what to turn over to the defense and what's Brady. And they're no less human than any of us, and they're just as prone as the next person to do what works best for them and their careers. That's why new trials and exonerations based on Brady evidence that's been withheld by prosecutors is not really that uncommon, which should make you wonder, what is this all about? Is the criminal justice system about actual justice based on truth? Truth that comes from all of the evidence, evidence that is both good and bad for the state, evidence that's made transparent to everyone? Or is it about winning a conviction? It is dangerous and troubling that the answer to this question really depends on the prosecutor you're dealing with. So we are at the point now where both the state and defense counsel are ready to meet in the battlefield, the courtroom. It's time for the jury to hear the state's case and the defense's case. And in the next couple of weeks, you get to be that jury, and you get to hear what they did as we present the culmination of the state versus Adnan Syed, the trial. Now, before we wrap up, we've got a few announcements. First of all, we've got a challenge for our listeners. This is a call to all of our creative graphic designers. Can you design the ultimate undisclosed t-shirt? The t-shirts can have our logo. They can be t-shirts featuring Susan, Colin, or me. They can be funky, pop art, impressionist, graphic, whatever your vision is. And you can design more than one t-shirt. You can do a whole line of them. The t-shirt selected will be sold on our website next year to benefit the podcast, with credit to the designer, of course. And the winner or winners will be invited on a paid trip to a very special event in March where they'll get to meet us all. So you can submit your designs to us in two ways.
You can email them to us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can tweet them at us by using the hashtag undisclosedt-shirt. Again, that's hashtag undisclosedt-shirt. The winner will be announced at the end of January. Which takes me to our next announcement. As we said in a prior episode, after we wrap up with Adnan's case, we will continue new seasons of Undisclosed by doing what we did with this one. Deep dives into other wrongful convictions. There are tens of thousands of others behind bars who don't have the kinds of resources that Adnan now has. And our listeners have proven that they care about justice, they care about the failures of a system that is meant to protect the innocent, and they care about the lives of people who have been destroyed not because they were just very unlucky, but because every part of the system failed them. So here's the thing. We have selected a new wrongful conviction case that we are all excited and intrigued by. It's got all the turns, twists, crazy characters you can imagine. And it's got a man in prison who doesn't belong there. But in order for us to investigate this and capture the story, we need help from our listeners. A new case is going to mean travel, collecting documents, and production costs. And for that, we need funding. So if you've either enjoyed the over 30 episodes of Undisclosed we've done so far on Adnan's case, or if you've learned something from our work, please consider making a small donation. You'll find the link to our donation site on our website at www.undisclosed-podcast.com, or you can go directly to it. The website is www.launchgood.com/undisclosed. We'll also be tweeting the link and sharing it on our Facebook page. Every dollar will help us exonerate another person who deserves freedom. Lastly, we want to wish our listeners an early but very happy Thanksgiving. Like all of you, we will also be taking time off to spend with our loved ones, and because of that, we won't be having a regular episode next week. Instead, we'll be playing clips from a recent panel that Susan was on. But in the following week, we'll be back to examine the entirety of the state's case against Adnan. So on behalf of Susan, Colin, I, and the entire team that makes Undisclosed possible, we wish you all a safe and happy holiday. A special thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, to Baluki, who designed our logo, and to Amar Naji, our sound editor. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us online on social media on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @undisclosedpod. Tweet us your questions and comments using the hashtag undisclosed.
The Undisclosed podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.